New York City's landmarks law was passed in 1965, and in the half century since, more than 1,300 structures have been given landmark status, and 135 historic districts have been created. Barbara Lee Diamondstein Spielvogel's The Landmarks of New York, an illustrated comprehensive record of New York City's historic buildings, is the definitive record of all those landmarks. And the sixth edition of the book, including the most recent updates, has just been published by NYU Press. Ms. Diamondstein Spielvogel is the founder and chair of the New York Landmarks 50 Alliance, chairperson of the Historic Landmarks Preservation Center, and chair of the New York State Council on the Arts, and was the longest-serving member of the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission. I'm delighted to welcome her back to our show. Hi.
How are you? And thank you for inviting me.
It's commonly assumed that New York City's landmarks law was a direct reaction to the demolition of Penn Station. Is it that simple?
I don't think so. To begin with,
you're having problems hearing the,
I think it just slipped off.
Okay.
To begin with, the Metropolitan Opera House, which was not a distinguished building, but had remarkable acoustics, was destroyed. Coincidentally, at the same time, there were a number of concerned citizens who knew that we had to do something to save our patrimony. But a number of the people deeply involved with the Metropolitan Opera were also very good friends of Mayor Wagner.
Now, I remember that building, which was, I think, on 40th Street between 7th and Broadway. What I remember is that whenever a production ended, they took all of the scenery and they put it on the street, and that was a major problem for many people. It just tied up traffic in an area that had a lot of street traffic, a lot of pedestrian traffic. And that was one of the reasons it was felt that they should build a bigger opera house with storage at Lincoln Center.
I think that perhaps is not quite as simple as that, too.
Because well, I was young at the time.
Younger. As you may recall, many of those projects were really real estate projects. For example, Rockefeller Center, Audubon Terrace. Well, in many ways, so was Lincoln Center. That was a very scruffy part of New York City before that redevelopment took place. And it started with a cultural complex, which was often the way, as far as I can see it, that the far-sighted Rockefeller family and their real estate interests proceeded with real estate development projects that you could do good and well at the very same time.
Is this something that was only happening in New York, or were we seeing similar things in other parts of the country?
Well, there were several hundred landmarks laws before ours ever took place. Well, the hue and cry of the Metropolitan Opera, Penn Station, and a person like Mayor Wagner, who had a deep civic concern and a history and a family history of deep civic concern. So he was very amenable to the idea, as there were a number of distinguished and or celebrated citizens who were in favor of that for probably since the end of the 50s. So along came 1965, and after much discussion and study, a landmarks commission was formed.
Now, there had been opposition to the destruction of much-loved buildings even before. When there was talk about getting rid of the Lever House, a friend of mine said, you know, I picketed the destruction of the building that made way for the Lever House, and now I'm going to have to go picket to save the Lever House.
Well, now it is saved, and I know
it
that's
was
a favorite subject of yours because I've heard you talk about it on other programs, but it is a designated landmark, and it's had several iterations. You know, that lovely garden inside was to be a garden by Isamu Noguchi, and there was an attempt about a previous owner about 20-some-odd years ago to restore that garden together with the art dealer of Noguchi, but it did not come to pass, and it's very unfortunate. It was a beautiful oasis.
How does the law define a landmark? Does it have to be a certain number of years old, or can a new building be landmarked?
Maybe a landmark of tomorrow, but the New York City Landmarks Law requires that a building be at least 30 years of age. It gives you an idea what a movable feast New York is, that we begin to venerate our buildings as compared to older cities of Europe and so on when they're 30 years old that have architectural and or cultural distinction.
So does it have to be judged to have architectural or historic significance? Who would determine something like that?
Well, there is a Landmarks Commission, as you know, but requests for consideration for designation come from the general public, as they do from the Landmarks Commission, concerned preservationists. It's a very democratic process at certain points. So these come in. There is, of course, always a queue, a long queue, and they are reviewed. And when they're considered worthy of discussion, deeply, deeply researched as to the verifiable information, the dates, the years, the architecture, how much of the original fabric remains. And it is a very important part of the patrimony of our city.
We're speaking with Barbara Lee Diamondstein Spielvogel about her book, The Landmarks of New York, an illustrated comprehensive record of New York City's historic buildings. The sixth edition has just been released by NYU Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So who gets appointed to the Landmarks Commission? Do you have to have some kind of background in architecture or urban issues?
A number of the people are architects. There's an historian, a lay member, and now I assume there's somebody for landscape, interiors, and so on as well. But it is a knowledgeable body that takes its work very seriously. And in spite of the differences, since its inception, there have been some less encouraging periods, but every mayor, in general, has withheld the law in a very sensible way because they too know how important it is to the fabric of our city. It's also the engine of our economy, and I'm not only talking about construction, architecture, and all the allied trades. Tourism and cultural tourism will soon be the number one occupation, pastime of citizens of the world. You see every day the streets of New York teeming both with residents and visitors who tend to love our city nearly as much as we do.
And they want to see the Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building, and, of course, they want to see the great museums, all of our patrimony. How long do the commissioners serve, and how long did you serve?
Well, I served, and it's hard even for me to believe, for 17 years and served under four mayors.
So that was probably a record.
I think it is the longest term, and I suspect it won't happen again. But it was in the earlier years of the commission as well, and some economic downturn periods when we would have very lengthy discussions, that it was a very good time to review what is appropriate for designation because little attention was paying to the work of the commission. Now it is a central fact of life, not only here, but more than, I think, nearly 5,000 commissions in the United States, public commissions, but thousands of private preservation agencies. We have some of the best in New York. Excuse me. We may have been a little late in starting our work in 1965, but since then I think it would be fair to say that we are the commission, the bellwether commission of the United States.
Finish your point.
Not only because it's the most expensive real estate, probably. But it is the greatest number. You pointed out, since your latest research, there are now 1,390 individually designated landmarks, 139 historic districts and extensions. In 1973, they decided it was a good idea to include interiors if they are accessible to the public. And I think there are 117 of those, but they must be largely open to the public. So your Aunt Pauline's living room is not eligible. But and by 1978-9, another category was added, and that's the last and very significant category, and that is scenic landmarks. To give you an idea of the diversity, there was the Magnolia grandiflora, a single tree that grew in Brooklyn, but every bit of Central Park, all 847 acres, larger than the entire Mediterranean municipality of Monaco, is our beautiful Central Park. Every bush, every statue, every overpass, every pond, all are considered one landmark.
And you have a section on lampposts, bracket lights, sidewalk clocks. It's,
yes.
Even cultural medallions.
They
can
are not
become
landmarks.
They haven't?
No.
You just have them.
I have cultural medallions in another part of my life. Would you like to talk about that for a moment?
No, actually, I want to get back to Penn Station, because we did, some years ago, we did a show on Penn Station, the destruction of Penn Station. It was pointed out that at the time, it was just seen as something that had become uneconomic, that it really
was... By the president of the railroad.
By the president of the railroad, but the railroad had built the building. Now, if something is uneconomic, but at the same time much loved, could you just force somebody to keep it up even though they're losing money?
Well, as always, Lenny, you raise the critical issues. We are a country, and I respect that deeply, of private property rights. We are also a country of a man or woman's home is his or her castle. So here you have the whole question of private property on the one hand, and on the other hand, the public patrimony. I fall into the category of respecting private property, but my overriding concern is that we're each temporary custodians of all we possess, privately or publicly, and that we are obliged aesthetically and morally, frankly, to pass on the best of it to the oncoming generations.
We're going to take a little break, and we'll come back with some of the things that are designated as landmarks. My guest is Barbara Lee Diamondstein Spielvogel. Her book, The Landmarks of New York, An Illustrated Comprehensive Record of New York City's Historic Buildings, is the definitive record of all of the landmarks, and the sixth edition of the book, including the most recent updates, has just been published by NYU Press. And we are back with Barbara Lee Diamondstein Spielvogel, talking about her book, The Landmarks of New York, An Illustrated Comprehensive Record of New York City's Historic Buildings, now in its sixth edition, just recently published by NYU Press, and quite heavy. How many pages is this?
I think 791.
Wow. Well, it's got lots of pictures as well. Can we just go through the process quickly? If I thought that a book, that a building or an interior or a district or whatever should be landmarked, and I go to Landmarks Commission, what happens after that?
Well, you can nominate it.
Yeah.
It is then reviewed by the research staff.
Anything that anybody nominates?
Well, within reason. We're talking about reasonable people making reasonable nominations, particularly when we already have 1,390. It should be have a very distinct architectural or cultural significance. and there are many that are not yet designated. You or the commission, commission members, a member of the public, can nominate a building that is then carefully researched and reviewed. After that research and review, it goes to the Landmarks Commission, and in their discussions, to determine which of those are calendared for public hearings. It's one of the parts of the landmark law that I have always liked the best, and I hope incursions to the public hearing process do not continue.
Many people were upset when the American Folk Art Museum, right down the block from MoMA, was not saved.
Well, it was not a landmark, so it was the purview of the public, which must mobilize to express itself. Just this very morning, I heard President Obama talking about the rights to demonstrate and free speech when done appropriately as the right of each of us in the democracy in which we live.
Was the Folk Art Museum not yet 30 years old? Was that part of the problem?
I don't know if that was the only issue.
Because when you look at the buildings, there are some that, of course, we expect to see: City Hall, the Municipal Building, the Flatiron Building, Cooper Union, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the New York Public Library Main Branch. But then there are some unusual ones, like Wing Hing Restaurant on Grand Street in Chinatown.
It's a very early, early building.
What makes that building worthy of landmark status? Just that it's old?
It is old. It plays a role in the history of Lower Manhattan, and it demonstrates a particular style. I think it was also once OTB in that building.
So
it was still a landmark.
So the interior wouldn't have been landmarked.
No.
On the other hand, we expect some interiors to be landmarked, like the Woolworth Building, which has those amazing mosaics, Grand Central Terminal, also many Broadway theaters. And when I go into some of those theaters and I look up at the ceiling, I'm so grateful that this incredible tradition that goes back 100 more or more years has been preserved.
And now some theater owners, in their playbill, call the landmark designation of their theater and cite some of the outstanding architectural features. That has happened, that in some instances people did not want designation, but once they have designation, they tend to advertise the structure as a landmark building. I guess the largest case in point would be the former Villard houses, then the Palace Hotel, and now the Lutte, a Korean company has bought it, Palace Hotel. There were years of arguments, and the first, as soon as it was approved, the company started to advertise it as a landmark hotel.
Now, sometimes people get around landmarking, like there's that fabulous building on Fifth Avenue had publishing houses and other things in it, and there was talk about knocking it down. Instead, what they did is they just took the back wall off and attached a hotel to it.
Well, that is the Villard house.
The Villard
house. Madison Avenue.
Oh, Madison,
but the other
sorry.
One was what was Sephora, and Scribner's was in that wonderful building, but it is a designated landmark.
Can landmark status be rescinded once it's been given? You include the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in your book, but write that its landmark status was granted and then rescinded, both in 2003.
Because Landmarks Commission does not have the final word.
But I would have thought that the St. John the Divine is almost guaranteed to be a landmarkable building.
Well, they have a lot of development going on in that area, and the city council has the final say, and that's who rescinded it.
Now, you mentioned that people may resist being landmarked, and then they publicize the fact. Does it add to the value of a building?
I think so. In fact, if you look even at houses for sale if they are designated a landmark, it is always included. And in fact, this sixth book, 791 pages of individual designations and photographs, and about 250 of them, the entire book is updated. So it's a new book, but it proves that landmarks law and designation does not freeze a building. There are many, many approved changes and adjustments that are made to building. There are several, very few, that are made without permission. And in fact, there is even a case where an entire story had to be removed because it was illegal.
John,
it does enhance value.
John from Brooklyn asks about the Gage and Tolner's landmarked interior. The building, he writes, is now a tacky shop, and they put up pink wallpaper.
Gage and Tolner's is a real issue because it was a restaurant, a gorgeous restaurant. It has now undergone several owners in a less than trafficked part. And obviously it just didn't have enough business. And I don't know about the pink wallpaper, and it is to be hoped a more sensitive next owner will bring it back. But these have to be viable places of business. And I'm not sure that pink wallpaper is a lure, but obviously the current owner, if it is legal, which I doubt, thought it was a lure to his customer base.
A lot of schools and churches have been landmarked. In the past, were those buildings seen as having social importance and therefore more important than just design and materials?
No. Many of those buildings are built by distinguished architects, indicated new ways of instruction, and of course the churches and synagogues of New York City are among the most beautiful buildings, but there is great care taken before designating houses of worship because their populations have changed so. Many of them are in center cities, and their congregations just no longer live there. There is a wonderful part of the Landmarks Conservancy, an excellent organization that deals only with houses of worship, and anyone who has any issues should really discuss it with them as well as the Landmarks Commission. They have an excellent program to assist and have had for many years.
There are also quite a few firehouses. There are firehouses on the list, and firehouses, for some reason, often are quite beautiful. Was there an attempt to make them beautiful when they were designed?
In fact, there was an attempt to make all public buildings beautiful. And Landmarks Commissions really arose earlier than I talked about with the City Beautiful movement that ended up in a World's Fair and venerated good architecture.
The IRT subway stations have been landmarked, but only the IRT because they are more beautiful than the INDs and the BMTs?
Well, the stations that have been designated have beautiful mosaic work. And if someone has a station that has been omitted, I'm sure the Landmarks Commission would like to hear about it. But usually the ones that are designated are really challengingly interesting.
In Coney Island, the Cyclone roller coaster and the Wonder Wheel are landmarked simply because they have played such an important role in our sense of Coney Island.
No, but also there were mechanical aspects of it that never occurred before. For example, there is a building in Soho, the Hallwalk building, one of my favorites, a cast iron building that incorporates two things. Firstly, cast iron, there were so many fires at the time that cast iron was really invented to think of a building material that would prevent that kind of destruction, make those buildings safer. But in that building, there is a first Otis elevator. And because of the cast iron, there could be huge pane glass windows, and a lot of shop fronts immediately understood what that showcase in a pre-television era would mean to passers-by. So without the cast iron and the Otis elevator, that could become multi-storied, and thereby starts, you know, the birth of the skyscraper. And now we know in New York City, with floor area ratio, FAR, the sky is the limit, because we're about to have some of the tallest buildings in the world, which I'm not certain, in fact, I am certain, is not the highest prize that can be awarded to a city.
Some of those long, narrow, small, whatever, needle-shaped buildings are so ugly, I can't imagine they'll ever be landmarked. But the Soho, there's a whole Soho cast iron district. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Charlton King Van Damme Historic District. Are we in it here in this building?
You are. In fact, aren't you between Charlton and Van Damme?
We are.
Right,
we
at
are.
This station.
On Varick.
So, and you, Leonard Lopater, a living landmark.
Well, that's only because I'm over 30 years old. But that's because this used to be the area where vice presidents lived. But we don't have their homes. We don't have Aaron Burr's house anymore. That was probably knocked down a long time ago.
Probably was. But just up the road in 22nd or 3rd Street, you have a Teddy Roosevelt dwelling that is both a local and national landmark and filled with a lot of artifacts.
There are some streets that are landmarked, Ocean Parkway and Eastern Parkway. Were they the first parkways in America?
They're scenic landmarks. Those boulevards and their beautiful alley of trees and places to sit are really very unusual.
There are landmarks in every borough in the city. Has the Landmark Commission begun looking more at buildings in the outer boroughs in recent years?
They have always, at least since my time, looked almost in an affirmative action way to make certain that the outer boroughs are included. But some of the oldest buildings, for example, the Wyckoff House in Brooklyn is 1641, and the Bound House, one of my great favorites, for its symbolic reasons as well, is circa 1661 in Queens.
And then there are a lot of older buildings in Staten Island, perhaps
yes,
because there's been no desire to knock them down and replace them with taller buildings.
Well, they're knocking down other ones and making mega mansions out of them, as you noticed all over. I think maybe that trend may have exhausted itself, and more sensible proportions will come back.
At the back of the book, you have a section called Sites Heard But Not Designated. Is this the backlog that the commission was dealing with last year? Because we heard about it being the largest ever.
Throughout the years, it was sort of my hall of shame, if you will, that there were 95-6 structures that had been heard, many of them more than 20 and 25 years earlier, and never designated. Well, as you know, after quite a to-do this year, they were finally reviewed. Unfortunately, there are only 30 that have been selected. The others go back into the domain, and if after a period of 5 years, they can be reconsidered, if in the judgment of the commission, it would be appropriate to do so.
Where are the landmarked lampposts? Are they all over
all
the city?
All over town.
Really?
Yes.
A listener wonders why the Edward Durrell Stone building on Columbus Circle wasn't landmarked and now has a very different look.
Well, it's a very good question. There were many people who wanted it to be landmarked. By the way, there is an Edward Durrell Stone private dwelling on East 64th or 5th Street.
That was his house, and he put a different front on it.
Well, that was actually a replica of the United States Embassy in India. He was a good friend of President Johnson's and had a lot of major commissions at that time, and he used that kind of curtain wall, and it is in front of that house. That house is not a landmark, but it does have a cultural medallion because, as you so rightly pointed out, it is where he lived and worked and is an exemplar of his work.
What about the Pepsi sign? Is that still being considered?
It's now a landmark.
Oh, it has been landmark.
Yes, and I think it's sitting right there. So you come up the East River Drive, greeting us.
And now we have talk about making the post office into the new Pennsylvania station with a number of competing ideas, Governor Cuomo's and then the Michael Kimmelman, Vishanj Chakrabarty counterproposal. This is going to go on forever, I guess.
No, I really think, if I may suggest, that action will be taken. I hope that's one of the ways that New York can interact with the new Trump administration. That is an idea that's long past due.
And I got to stop it here, unfortunately. Okay. Barbara Lee Diamondstein Spielvogel will be speaking at the New York Public Library's Mid-Manhattan branch on 5th Avenue and 40th Street on December 6th at 6:30. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for asking me.